The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Studio 7, I am your host, Alex Parnuk. Regardless of how you're listening, we are glad to have you joining us. When you have a few minutes, take time to browse around our media website, theflypod.com. We have a nationwide network of show hosts, and we podcast a wide variety of programs daily to thousands of small communities across the United States, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. When it comes to media, we are what's next. In this segment of America Speaks Out, we are pleased to introduce Jose Cabrera. Jose is a DACA alien. Let me first explain to the listeners what a DACA alien is. DACA stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That acronym refers to aliens that were under the age of 31 as of June the 15th, 2012. Also, that the alien entered the United States before reaching his or her 16th birthday. There's more. But let's get to Jose and his story. Jose, welcome to America Speaks Out.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your coming to America. You know, the how, the when, the where. And let me ask this question. Were you smuggled in?
So, as Alex said, my name is Jose Cabrera. I am currently a junior at Xavier University, and I was born in Veracruz, Mexico. It's a state by the Gulf of Mexico. The earliest memories I have really of Mexico were living in a small shack with aluminum walls, an aluminum roof. I remember we had like one bed and a bucket, and that's all we had, dirt floor and everything. And my father did what any other man would do that lived in Mexico and in those really harsh conditions, and just got married to a beautiful girl and had a son.
Your mom.
My mom. So he came to the United States, and the goal was you come to the United States, you make a little money, and you send it back home so then you can come home and live a happily ever after. And that's something that is in the kind of Mexican lifestyle, because throughout history, we've had the United States have always wanted Mexicans to come in to supply the surplus of work that we had. All of the great major wars, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, we wanted Mexicans to come in and work. We had the Bracero movement for 13 years. People were coming in. And so it was kind of like a duh, it's what you do. But what we realized is, my father realized is that life in Mexico, with the way it was going, especially after NAFTA, there was no future in there. Our economy was going down the gutter. There was no jobs. And even the people that had money were losing their money. So my father decided that we were going to come to the United States. And I remember the coyote, el coyote.
Yeah, the smuggler.
Sure. He had a son who was about my age and who was born here in the United States. So my father knew the conditions of entering without inspection, and he didn't want me to go through that because I was 4 years old at the time. So what happened is he paid a little bit extra, and the coyote and I went through the line, and he said I was his son. And I spent 4 days and three nights separated from my parents.
Which is quite traumatic, I would think.
Yeah, so the only memory I have of it is really we were in this blue GM van, and I was sleeping in my mom's arms, and we get off to the side of the road, and the lights on the car turns on, and I'm awoken. And then my mom's taking me out of the car, and we're out in this like middle of nowhere. I remember I looked up in the sky and it was pitch dark and you can see all the stars and moon. And it was a really cold night. So my mom had covered me in this blue blanket that my aunt had bought me before we left. And from a distance, I saw my father and the coyote talking. My father reaches into his pocket and hands him some money. And when I see that exchange, I feel my mom squeezing me. I turn to look at her. And when I turn back to look in front of me, I see the coyote right in front of me. And then I feel my mom squeezing me harder and harder. And next thing you know, I feel these hands pulling me away from my mother's arms. And I'm like kicking and screaming and yelling. And no one really told me what was going on.
They never explained it, huh?
They never explained it because they... I mean, how do you explain that to a four-year-old? Yeah, no. How do you explain to a four-year-old that we don't have enough money to barely feed you, enough money to give you diapers, that we have to enter this country this way because they're getting a visa in Mexico is too expensive? One, you have to prove that you're going to come back. So, in proving that means that you have to have money in the bank. It means you have to own land. You have to own property. You have to earn, like, at least in our village, it was owning cattle. So you had to own cattle. And owning all this qualified you to get a visa, a visitor's visa to enter the United States. And so we had nothing of that. And there was no possible way that we could have gotten a visa to come to the United States the, quote, right way.
Do you recall which one of the ports of entry you came through?
Well, I remember it was Phoenix.
Phoenix.
Because
technically you came in the right way, but the wrong way, as they might say.
Yeah,
hey,
yeah.
Just keeping on. Uh-huh. Since coming to America, I assume you've gone to high school and you've done a little college and maybe you're working. Now would be the time to put in a plug for the organization that you work for.
Yeah. So as I said, I'm a junior at Xavier University studying entrepreneurship with a minor in justice and peace studies. I also work at an organization called Intercommunity Justice and Peace Center, IJPC. It's a nonprofit organization that focuses on four core issues: peace and nonviolence, death penalty, immigration, and human trafficking. And I am the immigration program organizer. So within the immigration program, we have a group called YES, Youth Educating Society. And it's a group of high school students and college students, and we get them together to talk about immigration issues and to educate ourselves about the broken system and go out and educate others in our communities and in our society. We also give them life skills like public speaking, lobbying, storytelling, community building. And we also help students who are undocumented or have DACA status and really never thought they can go to college, and help them show like you can go to college. And also teach them how to apply, how to get scholarships. Because it's one thing being accepted to college, it's another thing how to pay for it, right? So we help them in that process. So that's a little bit of what I do.
In my opening, I kind of gave a brief description of what DACA was. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on to the listeners as far as how this program actually works?
Yeah, so you know, you talked about how you would have had to enter before you were 16. You have to have good moral character.
That's the key phrase today, right? Good moral character.
So good moral character can mean any different way, but the way they say you have to have no felony or misdemeanor or no more than three misdemeanors. You would have had to live in the United States for a long period of time.
Continuous residence.
Yeah. So meaning that when you apply, you have to give proof that you've lived here since January 15 of 2007. You would have had to say how you entered the country, the status that you lived in. You have to be going to school, getting your GED program, or going into the military.
Since getting the DACA, that would mean you almost have to admit to being an illegal alien, so to speak.
Yeah. You have to definitely say that you are undocumented. So, yeah. And then, you know, applying for it, that's a...
expensive?
That's expensive, yeah. It's $465.
Just for the application.
Just for the application, and that's not talking about... So, like, I want to talk about, for a second, what you have to submit, because it's a very...
rigorous process, I think.
Yeah, it is. So, okay, so before you apply, you have to gather all these proof. So, first you have to prove your identity. That means that you have to get some form of U.S. ID, like a state ID, or a passport from your native country, birth certificate, anything with a photo ID. So then you have to prove if you were ever or were in the Coast Guard. Then you have to prove your stay. So that means school records, hospital records, any type of official record that you have since 2007. But if you can find longer, so for example, we came to the United States in the 1999. So we were able to have all these proof of like hospital visits, pictures, anything just to prove that you were here for that long time. Then once you have all that ready, then you can actually start the application process. And you have to fly three different forms, an I-821D, and that's for the actual DACA. Within that form, you have to identify all the addresses you lived in. So that meant we had to go back and think about, okay, we entered in, you know, whatever date in 1999, and we went and lived with my uncle in North Carolina. So we had to get his address, get from this date to this date. So let's say we lived there on September 14 of 2000, and so to September 15 of 2001. So we have to say that, but then for the next address, it has to be the next date after that end
continuous
date.
Continuous residence.
Yeah, so it has to be, there shouldn't be any gap between your addresses. Then you have to fill out the I-765, and that's employment verification, getting that work visa. Because, so with DACA, it's a two-year work visa that we're, in a sense, getting. So we have to apply for that. And then it's an I-765-WS form, and that's pretty much stating your economic status. So that's writing a letter and saying, this is what I earned, this is what my family earned. And now when you're doing all this, everything that you're submitting has to be the same. So when I applied, my school transcript, it had the wrong birth date. It said that I was born on January 1st of 2010, where everything else said I was born February 12, 1995. So I remember first getting a letter from USCIS, and I was excited. I was like, yes, I got it. I finally got it. And it's this long letter saying, this form and that form doesn't go together, so you have to resend everything. So that meant I have to get all my paperwork. I had to make sure I canceled the check that was for $465 and sent another check for $465 and just send everything back in this big old white packet. Then once that is done, then you have to go to a fingerprint. You go to a local USCIS office in your city, and then you go through a whole fingerprint, which also goes through a background check, and they take your picture. And then once you go through all that, you get everything completed, you get this little blue card that looks exactly like the green card, but it's only blue. And then you get your Social Security, which on big red letters, it says, not permitted for reentry of the United States.
Well, what you're saying is that it's quite a laborious process that you have to go through.
And every process within the immigration process, it's exactly like that.
Now, you know, immigration right now, it's a real hot button item. Mm-hmm. And one of the big hot button items is the wall.
Yeah.
And they're planning to complete it now between Mexico and the United States. You, as someone that entered the way you did, what's your feelings on this, the wall?
Alex, this country has the right to protect its borders. So if this country feels that they feel safe with a big $4 billion or...
The figures run anywhere from a couple of billion to $16 billion. Who knows how much it's going to cost.
Right, so it's $1 billion in a sense. And so if the United States feel that they will be safe with this big $1 billion border, that's fine. But then we have to remember how much it's going to cost to maintain it. How many taxpayer money is that going to cost? Then let's actually know the goal of it, right, is to stop the flow of migration and to stop the drugs, to stop the guns. Is that really going to stop it when a few years back, the way that all the cartels were smuggling their drugs were tunnels underground?
Still doing it.
And are still doing it. I don't think that's going to stop. The border wall is just going to be a big wall that is going to be like a, kind of like
an
Trump's
image.
Signature of like, this was what I did in my presidency. It's not going to stop the flow of drugs. It's not going to stop the flow of people, because people have always come to this country because of the need. And we also have to understand the people that are coming. We have to understand why they're coming. And when we understand that, then we're going to see the reason for them coming. And we're going to also see that we're not going to stop, the wall is not going to stop them from coming.
I don't think it will. Luckily, I've had some time to look at the wall, and it does a lot of different things. And if you go back to one of my prior podcasts, you'll hear a whole story about why I think, my opinion of the wall is. Mm-hmm. But since then, I was just wondering, since arriving in the United States, have you had an opportunity to return to your homeland? And tell us a little bit about that in a form. And was it more like, there was a book written one time, A Stranger in a Strange Land. Mm-hmm. Could that be a good description of your visit back home?
Yeah. So with DACA, there's a program called Advanced Parole, and you can leave the country. And so my freshman year of college, I was given the privilege to go back and visit. And yeah, I would also explain it as like a fish out of water kind of thing. So I remember my first week, and again, we were dirt poor. So my first week, I kind of sat in my bedroom and just was like, I need to learn to adapt very quickly. Otherwise, it's not going to end well for me. And then I remember coming back, and when I get home, I was hugging my toilet because there was no toilet. And yeah, it was completely different. Even though everyone looked kind of like me, you can easily tell I didn't fit in.
It's almost like telling us that this America is your country now, where Mexico is a heritage.
Yeah.
My last question to you is, if you had the opportunity to meet President Trump, what would you ask or tell him?
I would ask him to start actually talking to the people who are affected and start understanding why people are coming here. Because you can't solve a problem without understanding why people are coming here.
So more information, basically, would be the issue.
More information about what we go through the immigration process. Because I always hear that there's no vetting, or that they're trying to find a way to cut through the line. Well, did you ever ask us what we wanted? Because most people would say, just give us an option to get in a line. Give us a line that we can sit on. I don't care if we're the last people on the line. Just give us a shot, an opportunity. And then if you really want to stop the flow of migration, understand why people are coming here. So understand that there's no real way, there's no like visa that anyone who's poor, who wants to live in this country can apply to. So maybe we want to start looking into that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank our guests for coming on America Speaks Out. I would also like to point out that anyone is welcome to come on a future episode of America Speaks Out and express their opinions and ideas about today's topics. The FlyPod Network is a neutral forum, so regardless of your point of view or political affiliation, it makes no difference to us if you'd like to come on our show. Contact us by email right here in the studio, shout@theflypod.com. Well, that's my show for today. From Studio 7, I'm your host, Alex Parnuk, coming to you free and clear through the New Media Network program feeds of theflypod.com. Until next time, thank you for listening, and so long.